go on to the fourth case, which is Catherine Anthony versus Country Life Manufacturing. Mr. Stein.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Your Honors, this case is a case of tremendous public importance. It's a case of great importance to the food industry, to manufacturers, and to retailers, to know what their responsibilities are. And up until the district court's opinion in this case, it had been abundantly clear to manufacturers that they had to comply with the FDA regulations, which govern what they can and can't put in the food. And you can't add ingredients that are outlawed by the FDA regulations merely by disclosing them on the label, which when you boil everything down here, that's what defendant's position is. Literally taken, is that if they put rat poisoning in their snack bars.
Is that what that is?
It actually is, Your Honor. That's correct.
Where's that? I was looking for that.
Where's it's not in a brief. Our position in the district court is that when the FDA prescribes something, we're not trying to second-guess the FDA. We're not trying to substitute our judgments. The FDA has made a determination something is unsafe. That's it. We aren't here trying to challenge them.
It's well, unsafe is different rat poison.
It is rat poisoning. It's a matter of public knowledge. You could the chemical chalacalciferol.
You went through this letter referred to. It said that we conclude that the above product is in violation of such and such.
Your Honor.
It says that it's, what is it, stevia?
Let me address your concern. There's two different chemicals. One is stevia.
The other
is chalacalciferol.
Okay. I only have the record. Is that one in the record here someplace, too?
Yes. It's in the complaint. It's everywhere in the record.
As far as the FDA's opinion of it.
No, the FDA's opinion. I mean, the complaint says that it's prescribed by the FDA. It doesn't say why. We didn't need to. We just say it's out. You know, in the notice pleading complaint, it's certainly sufficient to say the FDA does not allow this product to be in a food for human consumption.
Well, if that's rat poisoning, you obviously have some damages there. What are the damages here?
The damages are the purchase of the product. I mean, it's fortunate.
The cost of the bar.
The bar is plural. I mean, the plaintiff purchased several hundred dollars in these bars. Collectively, as a class, there were at least hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars of these bars purchased. And the defendant has made a profit from selling literally food laced with rat poison.
The complaint wants them to regurgitate that, which I guess is appropriate for this.
Yeah.
What do we do with it when we regurgitate it?
I don't think that's the issue here. I mean, the issue is...
It's a little bit. When we're talking about how you redistribute money to the people who claim, at least, to have bought these candy bars.
There are two issues in the complaint, first of all. One was, the first thing we wanted was an injunction stopping these from being sold. And if you look at the record, it's very clear that was first and foremost.
They up and did that, actually, didn't they?
They did with one of the products, not with the rat poison, at least not the last time we checked. But they didn't recall the product, and that's really terribly troublesome. What they did is they left the bars with the stevia on the market and quietly reformulated them to eliminate that ingredient. And, I mean, that's a horrible public policy to say, well, if you have a product that you know is illegal, just keep selling it and don't alert the retailers, don't alert the consumers.
Well, the FDA in the letter that you submitted to the other product just said, all right, you've got 15 days to tell us what you're going to do to remedy this.
That's correct. Okay. That was different manufacturers that the FDA's letters were to.
Different things wrong with the...
It was the same thing. I mean, the fact of the matter is the FDA is stretched extremely thin, and I mean, they've acknowledged...
That's what you're helping them out with.
Exactly. I mean, that's really what it boils down to, is this is a case of public interest. It's a case of public service. The FDA, for years, has relied on not just consumers, but retailers to help enforce its provision. Retailers, if they know a product is adulterated, they will not sell it. Juul's not going to sell your bar if they know it's not in compliance with the FDA regulations. And what I just discovered last night, and this goes to the express warranty, had we gotten discovery in this case, we would have almost certainly found that the defendant did make an express affirmation that the product complied with all federal FDA regulations, because apparently retailers, supermarkets, anybody who's in the food distribution chain will not sell a food manufacturer's product without that written affirmation. It's typically called the continuing products guarantee. And that's getting back to the point about damages. You know, the primary point was to get these products off the market. how you get these back to consumers is nothing new in class actions. You know, it may end up being a Cypre case. There will actually be a lot of consumers, like the plaintiff here, though, who can make a damage claim, because frequently people who eat these bars buy them in bulk. You know, they'll buy a box or two boxes and they'll put it on the credit card. So you'll have people who have receipts for $80, $100, $200 at a time in these purchases. The fact that there's no physical injury, you know, we should be thankful for it. It shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't develop a body of law that says to a food manufacturer, put whatever you like in your ingredient, in your products, and we'll spin the roulette wheel. And if nobody gets sick or keels over, you're home free. If they do, well, then you've got a problem. That's exactly why we have the FDA. It's a public policy decision that the government has decided that's not how we're going to do things. The FDA says this product isn't safe. You don't put it in the bar. We think it's not safe. Take your chances. The fact that she only suffered economic damages, there's a very proportionate recovery in the case, in that if she had suffered physical damages, obviously she'd be suing for hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, depending on the damages. The fact that it's purely economic loss, the punishment fits the crime. If they haven't killed somebody, if they haven't made somebody severely ill, if the only damage is that you've bought an adulterated product, it provides a good disincentive to a manufacturer not to do that, while at the same time...
Well, what was the incentive for the manufacturer to put this in?
I have no idea, Your Honor. It could be a few things. It's probably, I mean, I've had other, not similar cases, but vaguely similar cases, where you can't imagine why a manufacturer would do it, and usually it boils down to money. It could be the ingredients were cheaper.
That's usually when you leave something out of a product, when you have something in. I mean, I can't imagine why they would, and put it on the label that they put it in.
It could be money in the context also of just the cost of complying with the FDA regulations. I mean, you know, it costs you something to have either a staff attorney or somebody making sure your product is safe. So they may have just put it in there not known and not taking the proper steps to make sure they knew. I really don't know why it's in there. And they don't dispute that these ingredients are in there.
Yeah, well, they put it on the label.
They put it on the label, but that doesn't, I mean, case law is very clear. It doesn't. If you put something on the label, if the FDA says you can't put it in there. I mean, you know, cyanide is also an active ingredient. There's basically three chemicals on the market today that are the active ingredients in different forms of rodent poison. One, some are based with cyanide, some are based with salicylcalciferol, and there's a third, which I forget. But, you know, if you put cyanide on there, obviously a consumer is more likely to know cyanide is a problem than salicylcalciferol, but it's the same. You wouldn't say cyanide, fine, it's legal, you're stuck with the bars. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, so if Your Honors have no further questions.
Okay. Mr. Raskin?
May it please the Court, Your Honor, it's Richard Raskin on behalf of Happily Country Life Manufacturing. The words rat poison are ringing in my ears, so I'll turn immediately to that. The ingredients we're talking about are stevia, which is an herbal product, and a nutritional supplement, and a lawful product, and cholecalciferol, which is another name for vitamin D, which is a regular additive to milk, among other things. It is important to know we're hearing a lot of language about unfit for human consumption, adulteration. These are terms of art within the Food, Drugs, and Cosmetics Act. And it is true that certain products, if not pre-approved by the FDA, may have that regulatory status when included as an additive in food. Okay? But they may still be perfectly lawful products in other respects. And that is true of stevia and cholecalciferol, both of which you can get at the GNC around the corner. And use as much of it as you like.
Dietary supplements?
Yes.
The label you
yes,
use?
They are dietary supplements. And they're precise.
I don't understand how is a dietary supplement that apparently is not outlawed or poisoned or something is different than what is acceptable as an inclusion ingredient in food.
Yes.
I don't know the difference between food and dietary supplement. Diet is what you eat, isn't it?
Well, these are just purely regulatory categories that the FDA uses. And dietary supplements are thought to be, there are many of the vitamins, there are many of the herbal products that you often see in stores now. they're again lawful unless there is a reason to believe that they are unsafe. The FDA has every authority to take stevia, to take vitamin D or cholecalciferol completely off the market if they have reason to believe that it is unsafe. The FDA has not done that. So I think it's important to clarify that regulatory status up front. Now,
this letter that they referred us to here in the record, it's the one that Mr. Clyde Rockoff of Universal Nutrition, which is another company, obviously, and about another product. It refers to the adulterated with stevia. It said, unapproved food additives are considered unsafe under Section 409 of the Act. Now, that's the only reference to unsafe for anything that I've found in here, and I guess that designation means you can't use it.
Well, Judge Mannion, you're quite correctly pointing to the one place in the record of this appeal where there is any reference to what the FDA's position is by the plaintiff or the appellant here. It does not relate to this company, but it does show that there are staffers and there are district directors and there are some within the FDA who believe that including stevia within a product marketed as a food would cause that food to be adulterated and that action should be taken on that. That is an issue that has not been litigated. There are a variety of regulatory exemptions that might apply, including the grandfathering in of products that were being used when DSHEA or the Dietary Supplement Act was passed, including whether the product is generally recognized as safe. And this is a product that has been used for many, many years in many, many countries, often as a sweetener for tea and other products. The commissioner of the FDA has taken no position, has signed up on no position. The Secretary of Health and Human Services has taken no position. If this were an APA action here, there would be no final agency action on the question of whether these products are improperly used within foods.
Well,
all of that is a moot point for purposes of this appeal.
Well, this appeal is from a motion to dismiss,
12B6, yes,
and that they claim that with the notice pleading and the broad application of the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act that they've sufficiently stated a claim that shouldn't be dismissed. You're pointing out a lot of things that might come into later litigation, but is it okay to take this out at the 12B6 level, given the broad base of, I guess, the Consumer Fraud Act and notice pleading?
Judge, it is. Judge Hibbler did the right thing, and the reason is that there are three things we know here that preclude this case from going forward. The first is, as you all have pointed out already, it's as plain as day on the product label that stevia and cholecalciferol are included in these products. So there's no sense of deception. There's no sense of, I didn't know what I was getting here. The allegation really is, I didn't know of the precise FDA regulatory category in which these particular ingredients were placed. I didn't understand that these were perfectly lawful to buy and to consume if they were being marketed as dietary supplements, but that there is an ambiguity as to their status when they're included in food. That's a disclosure that could not fit on any product label, except for a very large product. And moreover, it's a question of law. It's not a question of fact. There was no misrepresentation of any kind. There was no representation at all as to this legal question that plaintiff is raising. The other thing that we know here is that there was no personal injury, certainly, from the product. If there were, this would be a difficult case to try and take into a class action, and that's what's going on here. We have an effort to turn this into a class action by saying personal injury doesn't matter. Everybody who bought the bars has been injured by the price that they paid. Judge Hibbler said that's not injury that could have been proximately caused by the defendant. He said it might be but for causation, but that's not good enough. I think he may have actually been too generous. I don't think it's even but for causation. If you consider it, the plaintiff bought these bars, she consumed them, she got presumably exactly what she paid for, And to reimburse her now for the cost of the bars would be an overcompensation. In fact, you can imagine that had she not purchased these bars, she would have purchased some other food product. And so there is no damage whatsoever. There's not even a dollar of damage under any theory, even financial injury, even under a theory of but-for causation. But in any event, certainly, no injury proximately caused. There was a disclosure. And so one has to stretch very, very, very far to imagine any kind of conceivable injury. In our view, that dispenses both with her claims under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act and with the UCC claims, because both of them require that the plaintiff allege some form of injury. Now, the question that I was addressing earlier about the regulatory status, those are issues for the FDA. And that is one reason why, again, Judge Hibbler quite correctly threw the case out at the 12B6 stage. Because to allow a case like this to go forward, when there is no allegation other than that there was a sort of pure regulatory violation, there is an allegation that there was a regulatory violation, but there is nothing more than that. There is no allegation that somebody was hurt by that, that this plaintiff, or frankly, anyone else, was hurt by that. That's what the FDA does. That's what the FDA has the power and the ability to take action on. And there are a series of cases, including the Sandoz case and the Third Circuit, the Braintree case, with both of which we cite in our brief, where courts have said, lacking any injury to this consumer, we cannot allow a cause of action, whether it's under the Lanham Act, whether it's under a state consumer fraud law, to proceed purely against a regulatory violation. The Sandoz case, a product was marketed, and the question was, should one of the ingredients have been marked as an active ingredient or an inactive ingredient? This was a drug that was being marketed. And the Third Circuit said, you can't bring a Lanham Act action for false advertising based on whether it should have been active or it should have been inactive. That's a misbranding question for the FDA. Absent some showing of harm to a consumer there, that sort of case can't be allowed to proceed. And we have precisely the same thing here, and that's why Judge Hibbler, he used the term preemption, but whatever term you choose, that's why he followed those cases in saying that it would inappropriately step on the jurisdiction of the FDA to permit class actions to proceed, to enforce pure regulatory requirements absent any showing of injury to the consumer herself.
Well, preemption is more than a one-line holding, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I don't know that that was even intended in sort of the Article 6 Supremacy Clause sense. That's not a point that we argued. It's not a point we argued today.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Kahn?
Your Honor, there's a lot of things I'd like to rebut, and I'll try to get to them quickly. Let me just say, for example, the Braintree case and many of the other cases that opposing counsel just cited as saying there's a physical injury requirement or that you can't rely on an FDA regulation absent a physical injury. Absolutely, positively wrong. The Braintree case was a case between, it was commercial litigation. And it's in our brief. We cited numerous case after case where private litigants in commercial litigation, companies that can't literally in any sense of the word suffer a physical injury, are allowed to regulate and cite FDA regulations. The Supreme Court has expressly approved that in the Medtronix case. As for the dietary supplement issue, we addressed it on page 2 of our response brief in the district court, footnote 3. This is not a dietary supplement. There's very strict requirements for what is or isn't a dietary supplement. It has to be clearly labeled as such, and even in this case, if they had labeled it, it wouldn't meet the requirements, but they didn't label it. Absolutely beyond dispute, this is not a dietary supplement. As for the economic damages, that's what the Consumer Fraud Act is for. That's what warranty claims are for. If there's personal injury, the state's courts have really parsed that out since they adopted 402A, the Restatement of Torts, and said we take care of physical injury and tort, and economic injury in contract law, which is what we have here. So that's, we didn't allege a tort, you know, 402A type violation. The point that the defendant is misleading the court and is just wrong. Federal regulations say you cannot put these ingredients in the product unless they're approved. They don't say, you know, what, I mean, it's the defendant here who really wants to revisit the whole FDA scheme. These ingredients are not approved. They never argue that they're approved. They don't deny that they're not approved. Further and finally, on notice pleading, it's sufficient to say that the FDA considers the products adulterated. If we hadn't said that at all, if we just said plaintiff bought a wholesome, unadulterated food product and turns out it was adulterated, that states a claim for breach of warranty. It states a claim under the unfairness test, clearly, on the Consumer Fraud Act. I don't see how, by throwing in the allegation that, by the way, the FDA agrees with us that this is adulterated and unsafe, can I finish my sentence?
Finish.
Somehow under notice pleading, as soon as the FDA agrees with you, then you convert it to a federal cause of action. Thank you, Your Honor, if you have no further questions.
Okay, thank you. The case will be taken under advisement.